Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solaire Report. I'm Ricardo Oskam, and I'm here joined by my co-host Nina Hein, who is the host of the Food for the Soul series and has a tremendous wealth of knowledge of the art, as you by now have established. Nina, today we're going to talk about our recent adventures in Philadelphia. We traveled to the Philadelphia Museum of Art to specifically look at the women in art, the women behind the canvas, not the models, correct?
Correct.
So tell us why. Why do we focus on the women only?
Well, let me start by saying that Philadelphia Museum of Art is a vast, huge building that is one of the type of museums that they did in 19th century, which were kind of collections of everything that has ever been available for the educational and artistic purposes. So the 19th century museums, like the ones in New York, for example, and the ones in Washington, if we talk about the United States, or the Louvre in Europe, started out as museums where they would collect everything. So you would have the antiquities, you know, anything from Egyptian mummies to medieval armors. Then they would have pottery and textiles. And of course, there would be a selection of paintings of art. So this is that kind of a museum. That particular one was established or opened in 1876 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Declaration of Independence in the United States. So it was kind of like a centennial celebration in America. And it was, from the beginning, a huge, vast building that is in the middle of Philadelphia until now. And it is impossible for anybody, no matter how dedicated, to kind of take it in one day or in a few hours, and especially not if you're just visiting for a couple of hours. So first of all, you always, when you go to a museum like this, you have to kind of limit yourself. Okay, today I'm just going to be looking at the Egyptian and antiquities and or textiles or whatever. For us, we decided to go to the painting section. And also, to limit ourselves further, we decided that we're going to go on a little treasure hunt and look for the paintings done by women artists, of which there is not that many. And the reason we did it is because we are hoping that we are going to have a book that I wrote called Women in Art, Artists, Models, and Those Who Made It Happen. That's the title of the book. That this book is going to be coming out as a Solaris first publication.
Right.
And in that book, I talk about a lot of artists, women artists, who throughout centuries have been painting paintings. And it so happens that at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, we found several of those paintings written, you know, painted, created by those artists. So that was our goal, to go through this vast museum, but on a treasure hunt, and to find the ones that we wanted to kind of explore further.
Right. And just to stop on a third topic of the book. So it's the women behind the canvas, it's the women on the canvas, but it's also the third category of women that made it happen, that were responsible for allowing people to paint through financial means, for example, but also women that changed the course of how women painted at all, that they were maybe not allowed to join a guild, for example. And we'll get to all of that as we make our way through the six women painters. So before we do that, you mentioned something very interesting to me. So you really opened up my interest in the arts by taking me to the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam last year and talking about Johannes Vermeer. Then this was our second sojourn into the world of arts. And when we spoke about why everybody needs to dive into this and really study it and what it can bring to your life, you mentioned something that really stuck with me. So you said in our very structured and orderly day-to-day lives, where some people might have a 9-to-5 job and have a very rhythmic structure every single day, the often chaotic nature of the arts is something to explore, something that breaks open that order and creates a little bit of chaos for you to enjoy. And in that chaos, there's something personal that speaks to everyone. And we're going to talk about what spoke to me or what spoke to you as we played the game of, if I had infinite resources and the opportunity to buy something there, what would I take home? So we'll get to that at the end, which is always that's
Prince's famous game. You go to a museum and you pick one painting that you're taking home, and which one is this going to be?
Right.
So that game we always play when we go to museums. It was a pleasure going with you and discovering things that we have discovered together or have been unexpectedly confronted with in terms of art. But yes, I agree with you. I just think that the reason I named the website that I write all those art stories Food for the Soul, because I just think that you need to nourish your mind by reading books, talking to people, traveling. And you need to nourish your body in order to function. But there's also the third component to it. In other words, you need to nourish your, you can call it spirit or soul or the yourself, if you like, by being exposed to things out of ordinary. That I think that art kind of pushes you out of the day-to-day grooves of, you know, what the French call, you know, métro boulot dodo, which means going on the metro, going to work and sleeping. And you need to sometimes to be pushed out of this ordinary existence towards something that is transporting you to something better and nicer. So I think that's what art does. And that's what we did on this wonderful afternoon a few days ago when we were just wandering and trying desperately to find the specific paintings that I want to talk about. And it wasn't easy because they were really hidden.
They were hidden. And it was very interesting to see you sort of try and negotiate with some of the guards who were walking around to try and find these paintings specifically that we were looking for. And obviously you speak about six languages fluently, so your pronunciation of some of these French names was just was very interesting to see you talk.
Saying like, what, lady?
Right. But let me tell you, Nina, your wealth of knowledge is very impressive, and I really enjoyed talking to you about these paintings. It breaks open my understanding of history and really puts everything into a contextual wrap. So talking about the painters from the Dutch Golden Age and why the sudden change from mythology and theology and mythology as a theme in these paintings to more everyday life scenarios, these genres. To hear why that happens from you just broke open my my understanding of history and puts it into a context where it's so much more exciting to learn about these things. So thank you for doing that. And without further ado, let's jump into our first painter today.
Yes, that brings us actually to a Dutch artist. So we're in your home turf, Ricardo. The first one that we were looking for is the artist, I'm going to mangle her name, but it's known in the West at least as Judith Leister. Is there a better Dutch pronunciation of that?
Well, that's very accurate. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so she is the Dutch Baroque, meaning 17th century artist, a woman, who has been a student of a much more famous artist called Frans Hals that has been recently throughout Europe a big exhibition to celebrate an anniversary. And there was a big exhibition of Frans Hals art. And she painted paintings within the genre that you have been referring to, so-called genre scenes, which means kind of anecdotal paintings of something happening that was either kind of a satire, so kind of for an enjoyment of the viewer, and sometimes more realistic. The painting that we have seen at Philadelphia is called The Gay Cavalier, gay being happy or joyful. And it shows two people drinking. One of them is kind of standing happily with a glass raised and very drunk at this point. Mm-hmm. The other one is sitting and also drinking. But the moralistic part of that painting comes through the third actor in that scene, and this is a skeleton, so this is a symbol of death, of course, who is holding a time glass to show that the time waits for nobody. And of course, the moral of the painting is that if you drink too much or drink yourself to death, then sooner or later you're going to end up in the company of that skeleton. So it is kind of a moralistic admonishment that one should not drink too much. But the way she paints it is kind of very dynamic. These two people are standing and drinking almost as if they were in the tavern. Even the skeleton is bending forward. So there's a lot of movement in this painting. There have been, obviously, genre scenes like this, but probably much more static and more subtle. You know, hers is kind of very a buoyant way of telling the story through painting. To me, the interesting thing is that Judith Leister has died in 1660, literally. And for about 230 years, till 1893, something like this, she has really been forgotten to the point that at the very end of 19th century, there was a painting of hers at the Louvre that had a different name. But when they were cleaning the painting, they discovered her signature underneath the layers of dirt, grime, and somebody else's signature. And they started getting interested. Well, who is Judith Leister then? If someone like this has signed a painting, who is this person? And then they started looking at various paintings of that era. And until today, practically, there are paintings that have been misattributed to very often to Franz Hals because he was her teacher. And it's the same kind of style of painting and the same kind of light, the something that you paid attention to and that you looked at and then you really liked the way the light and shadow is playing in this painting. And they started discovering, oh, no, 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 there was another painter. And what's more, she was a woman, but she was completely not appreciated until practically, you know, the 20th century.
Her husband also was a painter, correct? Who was also falsely attributed.
Yes, well, that's what usually happened in, well, and into the 19th century, that a woman painter very often would be a wife or a daughter of a painter, and that's how they would get exposed to paint materials and the painting as an occupation, because they would not be going to painting schools. That was the main of men. And in fact, if we look at the second painting that we have found, that we had very hard time finding at the museum as well, by a French artist from the 18th century, her name is Elizabeth Vigée Lebrun. She was the young artist who already had the skill as a teenager. She was a daughter of a painter. The problem was that when she started painting, she was not the member of the Guild of Painters, which a painter needed to be. So at some point, the guild confiscated her painting materials, and she was forbidden to paint because she was not a member. She was not allowed to do to practice her craft.
Why did somebody need to be member of a guild in that time to be able to paint?
That was the law. You want to paint, you want to collect money, you want to get paid for painting, you have to be part of a professional association.
Right.
Well, anyway, I mean, in Hollywood, if you want to work on a film set, you know, you have to be a member of the guild of carpenters or electricians. You cannot just go on the set on a union shoot and not to be a member of a union. So those laws exist till today, but they were very kind of stringent, meaning severe, and applied to painting at the time when she lived.
Right.
So what happened was that eventually she managed to become the member of the guild, and then she started supporting her family because her father died when she was young. So she was left with her mother and her brother, and then her mother remarried. Elizabeth's stepfather was not a very nice man. So the teenage Elizabeth was supporting the entire family by painting.
Imagine that responsibility at that age, as a teenager, having the responsibility to finance the existence of your family, well, part of what's left after all the tragedies. That, I wonder since painting is such an expression of creativity, if you're forced to paint to create a financial, if you have such a strong financial incentive, would that inhibit the creative aspect of the painting at all?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, at some level, definitely, if someone has to make a living creating a little landscapes right. of, you know, I don't know, little doggies in the forest, because that's what sells, then yes, it kills your creativity. She was very lucky and unlucky. This is the story that I kind of write in the book. How her life was kind of going up and down throughout her life for no fault of her own. So here you have the young woman who has lost her father and is supporting her family, and it is going medium rare, so to speak, not the greatest. But then she manages to befriend a woman called Marie Antoinette. So befriending a queen usually means that this is going to be fantastic, because you become a court painter, which she did, and painted dozens of portraits of the queen and all the members of the court, her children, all the aristocrats. This was great. The only problem was that poor Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun could not stop the winds of history blowing, and her patron has lost her queenship and her head at some point. And poor
Quite
Elizabeth
unfortunate timing.
French Revolution. Right. And ended up in exile for many, many years, going from one country to another, ending up in Russia, Tsarist Russia, for many years. And that was maybe not the happiest time of her life, but that's how she had to manage. In fact, she had the last word, Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun, because eventually she managed to come back to France, and she has like outlived, I think, six different rulers of France.
Wow.
Because, she lived to almost mid-19th century. So she has outlived them all. She lived until she was 86 years old. But her life was constantly ups and downs. And the funny thing is that the painting that you and I have seen, which we have liked, right? It was a nice...
Oh, absolutely.
A very nice portrait.
It is a very nice portrait, just on face value. But then you started to explain why it's relevant too in terms of its historical context, because when you think about how ladies in that age would be, would usually be the style, the trend of clothing, how they would usually portray themselves was very different than this lady we see in the picture, who's wearing a straw hat, which is for those aristocratic families at the time, very unfitting. Right?
Well, yes, but the young Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun, who had as a patron a young Marie Antoinette, meaning two young women, very much kind of imbued with the theories of Jean-Jacques Rousseau of, return to nature and shepherdess and all this more natural life, they have introduced a new fashion at the court, which was exactly the straw hats and the muslin dresses, never mind the crinolines and,
right.
And flowing hair instead of wigs. And that painting reflects the change of fashion, the kind of, obviously it was a kind of fake shepherdesses and they were still aristocrats, but they just wanted some change in the looks. So those two, the painter and the ruler and the queen, have kind of been the fashion forward game changers that were a harbinger of the new era. The problem is that the revolution was also part of the right. harbinger of the new era. swept both of these women off the place that they were in. But the irony here is that the portrait that we were looking at is the portrait of Madame du Barry, who was the official last mistress of King Louis XV, who was the father of Louis XVI, the husband of Marie Antoinette, the one who lost his head. So she was the mistress of the father. Marie Antoinette did not particularly get along with her so-called stepmother. But Madame du Barry was... at court and had official portraits painted. the irony was that she was from very modest background, to put it mildly, right? So proletariat, if you like. After the old king has died, Louis the 15th has died, she was living in a little chateau, you know, outside Paris. And when the revolution came, the mob attacked the chateau, you know, seized poor Madame du Barry, who was not that young at the time anymore. And then she ended up at the guillotine, you know, she got her head cut off as an aristocrat. And obviously the funny thing, or the irony, or this bitter irony here, is that she was definitely not an aristocrat. You know, she was a mistress, ex-working girl, so to speak, from proletariat. And it was the proletariat who killed her. it's kind of sad and ironic at the same time. So this is the person that Elizabeth has painted at the height of her fame and beauty. But this is the story of the two women and what happens when they get mixed up with the revolution.
Right. Well, it's a fascinating life story. And it's also very interesting if you think about back in those days, you didn't have televised fashion shows. So probably the way people learned about fashion in different countries was through paintings. So I just wonder how that influenced how people thought about France and the fashion over there. Anyway, that's fascinating. That's really fascinating. This is one of those in the third category. If you think back about the start of our conversation, women that made it happen. These two ladies conspired. They definitely changed some trends. They definitely made that happen. So that's very interesting. Our third lady definitely. I love this lady. This is Rosa Bonheur, a third lady. I love her story. This is a woman with a very powerful voice and was not afraid to tell people what she really thought and what she really enjoyed, how to express herself. So go ahead, without further ado, let's dive into Rosa Bonheur and her fascinating story.
So we are going to look at the painting that is modestly entitled Two Horses, by indeed a painter called Rosa Bonheur. And this sweet girly name should not be the indicator of who this person was, because who she was a daughter of a painter. So she already had the skills and the access to making art. But from the very young age, she was a tomboy. She had several brothers. Her father thought that maybe the brothers, several brothers, several boys that he had would become painters, but it ended up that she was the one who was the painter. And she was in love in painting animals. She would, have her own menagerie of pets. She would go to countryside to paint animals. She would... not be very interested in portraits or landscapes, or all those girly kind of flowers, you know, all those girly type of paintings. She was interested in animals, and the bigger the better, you know, the cows, the horses, that kind of paintings. She was also quite eccentric. And she was clearly not interested in the normal ladylike life. She would be going to the horse fairs to sketch and draw the horses that she would later paint. And she was wearing pants. This is, we're talking mid-19th century, right?
Right.
In order to do so, she had to get a permission from the local police to actually do so, to wear pants, because that was an offense and that was not allowed. So under the guise of the fact that, you know, she has to go and be at the horse trader's market, and it was kind of a little bit difficult to be in a crinoline to be doing paintings, so they allowed it. But she literally had to carry a permit from the police. So this is the times in which she was creating things.
Right.
She was a very spunky, energetic person. She also had an incredible talent. This painting of two horses was painted when she was barely 20 years old. And if you look at this painting, you know, you can Google it, or, you know, if you go to the museum, and it's just like so beautifully painted.
Right. And there's a reason why she understood the anatomy of animals so well, you explained.
But she would go to abattoir, for example, and study the, you know, the chopped up bodies of horses and cows, you know, when they were preparing steaks. And, you know, basically do the same thing that Da Vinci did several hundred right. years before, right? You know, go and look at the anatomy of what he was drawing, which was good for the painters, but of course not an occupation for a mid-19th century lady from Paris, right? She was supposed to be wearing beautiful dresses and straw hats and paint flowers, and right. she would have none of that.
Right. And there's one example of her being very eccentric lady, which is this portrait that was drawn by somebody else of Rosa Bonheur herself, where she was actually leaning. Originally, she was painted leaning on a chair. Mm-hmm. But as I read it, she didn't think that the chair was exciting enough. So instead, she just painted a cow instead of the chair, and just completely changed the painting. But it looks perfect. It looks as if this is the original. But this was just her being unhappy about the chair and would rather be leaning on a cow.
Yeah, because she was not interested in chairs. She was interested in cattle, so to speak, as people, meaning as models for their portraits, you know. And when you see Catherine Olley and I went the next day, we went to a museum called National Museum of Women in Arts, and there is another Rosa Bonheur painting. And this is a painting of a group of cows, and every single one of them has a different face, if you like, and a different pose and a different expression. For her, you know, it doesn't matter if she was painting a lion or a dog, you know, this was a person that needed to be somehow portrayed with a character and the looks. She was a very unusual artist.
Did she try and implement the human emotions into those faces of the animals?
I don't know if we need to anthropomorphizing, can't pronounce the word, that much, but she was much more, I would say that as an artist, she was much more attuned to what she saw in the animals. And also remember, this is 19th century where, you know, there are no animal shelters, you know, animals are not treated very nicely, even the pets, you know, even dogs and cats were not treated very nicely. They were kind of utilitarian.
Right, they served a role and that's it, a basic utility. And
yeah, there was not too much of a 21st century sensibility when we dress up dogs in clothes and we polish the claws of cats, right? This was not that era. You know, animals were utilitarian. Dogs were supposed to guard the house. You know, the cat was supposed to catch mice, and the rest you just ate, right?
Right.
So, and she was saying, I see much more humanity and personality in all the models of animals that I paint than in the people. There's a painting, if you read this article that I wrote in the book, she at some point was fascinated by Buffalo Bill, you know, the epitome of being a cowboy, if you like. And she met him. His real name was Colonel William Cody. And she did paint his portrait, which is a nice portrait of him sitting on a horse, but she spent much more energy and skill and talent on painting the horse rather than...
Right. The horse was the real star.
So that tells you, you know, where her priorities lay. I think she's, you know, the most non-conforming artist of her era, you know, to run around in pants and, you know, paint cattle when everybody else, you know, all the women were painting flowers and talking about, I don't know, whatever it is, but certainly not cattle.
Right.
It takes a lot of guts, you know.
It takes a lot of courage.
Yes.
Wow. She's world renowned right now, isn't she? Where the big painting with all the horses, the many horses. I forgot the name of this painting, but that has received a medal by the King of Spain.
I read. Yes.
So this is world famous.
Right.
Wonderful.
No, she was not, she's getting more and more recognition also because she was a female painter and, for every 100 male artists, there's one woman painter. So, of course, there's so few of them that any of them right. is now kind of celebrated. But I think also that at some point, obviously, throughout most of the 20th century, the art was not celebrating anything particularly realistic. It was abstract art or surrealist art or any kind of, pop art. These are the types of styles of painting in the 20th century. So someone who paints realistically cows was not particularly celebrated. Mm-hmm. Now it's obviously she's getting a little bit of a renaissance.
And in line with those themes, our next female painter is Bertha Morisot.
Mm-hmm.
And her main theme is motherhood and the very intimate scenarios of motherhood. A woman standing beside her children and in very day-to-day situations. But that's also a world that was very close to men in that day and age, right? Where men were out working and maybe away to hunt or be out on long trips, where mothers would stay at home with the children. So this, who better to paint that than a mother herself? She was very observing and very close to that world, right?
Right. I mean, there is something that should be said, though. Bertha Morisot was not, she was part of the high society in France, if you like,
Mm-hmm.
She took lessons from Courbet. She was extremely well-placed in the society. She would spend a lot of time, going to theater, opera, and hanging around with writers, painters. She was married to a brother of Edouard Manet. So she was not someone who she obviously had enormous talent, but she was already well-placed in the society. She was quite right. sophisticated. In that sense, she's much different from many women painters who basically were apprentices or daughters of painters and then, they kind of made a way up the ladder. Bertha Morisot is part of the French society of the second part of the 19th century. In fact, she was also friend and collaborator with all the Impressionists because she is the only woman who was part of the first Impressionist exhibition in 1874 when a group of painters, such as Monet, for example, and Pizarro and Degas, the artists who decided that because their new style of painting, meaning what we call today Impressionist, is not being accepted by the establishment, if you like. The establishment would have this annual show called Salon in Paris, where all the artists would bring their paintings and then the paintings would be shown and the people would buy the paintings. So after several years of having their paintings rejected, they said enough is enough and they decided to mount their own exhibition, which happened in 1874. She was part of that exhibition. So she was part. The core group of Impressionists and part of the art history, they sad or, maybe not surprising fact is that of all this group, everybody was very celebrated or until very recently, except her because she was a woman. So it was like, oh, okay, she's painting right. women and children and she's a woman. She was not as famous. Now she's getting a little bit of recognition because there have been several major exhibitions of her art. And when the art historians are kind of taking a second look at her art, they recognize that she actually has as much talent as anybody else in that group. But she was always less prominent, I would say.
Was the audience at these shows, like Le Salon, were they traditionally men and women who showed
men
up to
women,
these events?
But very bourgeois kind of, people who wanted to have a nice landscape realistically painted, possibly with some flowers and butterflies and And something that you can put on the wall of your living room and be very happy about. And then the impressionists come in and then, you know, everything is just splashes of color and very vivid colors. And it's not painted exactly. You know, sometimes you cannot even recognize the face very well. And it's like, what the hell is that? I'm not buying that. Right. So they struggled for quite a long time. You know, when you and I live in 21st century and we look at it and then, you know, we talked about it, you and I, you know, we love the colors. We love the very fact that this is not exactly realistic because we're used to that, right? We spend 100 years, these paintings have been living amongst us, so to speak. But in 1874, forget about it. Nobody wanted that kind of art. Everybody wanted a nice, realistic landscape, right?
This is where the art that people display in their houses, it serves a very, very social element too, where it's all about displaying that you have something that, in general, the current trend appreciates and not just you on a personal level, right? It's very much fitting with the trend and not breaking it. Where if the trend doesn't appreciate it, it's far less likely to be bought and portrayed in one's house for social events. So,
correct.
All right. Well, with that, let's move on to woman number five, female painter number five, Marie Cassatt. Do I pronounce that correctly?
Cassatt, I think. She has two T's at the end. Well, she has this kind of Frenchy type of name, but she wasn't French at all, even though she lived most of her life in Paris. She is a Philadelphia native.
Right.
Born in Allegheny in Pennsylvania. So she's kind of, you know, the native of that region. And she was born into an upscale part of the Pennsylvania society, if you like, in mid-19th century, 1844. And the family, thank God, had several children, so there was not that much pressure on her to follow the recognized social pattern of, you know, getting married and properly and living in the society. Since she did have talent, the family was fine with her going away and studying in Paris. And in fact, at some point after her very successful father kind of semi-retired, he and his wife, so Mary's parents, moved to Paris and lived with her the second part of their life. In their retirement, they lived with her. She has never married, never had the family, but she had a large slew of nieces and nephews that she adored. And she, similar to Barrett Morisot, it's more or less the same time. She's 3 years younger than Morisot, but she lived much longer because she lived till 80. But Cassatt, like Morisot, is the painter of women and children, you know, the kind of domestic scenes. In fact, this is her trademark. Ironically, she never had the children of herself. But maybe this is for an artist is very good because she was not distracted with household life because she could just sit and observe and quietly paint. So she's obviously more celebrated impressionist than more well-known. And certainly she's well-known in the United States.
Could it also be that it was maybe a way of filling up that gap of never having had children herself? This was a way of studying that world, of dipping her toes into the world of motherhood without actually being a mother herself. I wonder if there's a psychological reason there.
Absolutely, Ricardo. Very good insight. I think you hit the nail on the head. Yes, I think that that has definitely fulfilled some psychological need. And we have great art out of that. She's also very kind of interesting in terms of a biography because obviously she was an American. She wasn't French. So she moves from the United States where the art at the time is extremely traditional. Of course, nobody has heard of Impressionism. She moves to Paris, studies there, and then she wants to... First, she wanted to participate in the salon. You know, she submitted her paintings. Then a couple of them were even accepted. So she writes home, oh, I'm so happy, you know, they accepted my art. This was a little bit, the paintings that were accepted to the Salon were kind of, you know, the Spanish dancer, kind of like Jean scenes of the Dutch Baroque kind of thing, you know. She goes to Spain, she paints the woman with a mandolin. You know, she's an American creating in Paris, woman in mandolin. It's like, it's clearly, you know, a nice painting for Salon, because this is something that people want to put on the wall, but right. It's not yet expressing her art. Then she fails to be admitted. You know, a couple of years, she's not, her paintings are not accepted to the Salon. And this is obviously a drama for a painter, because if your paintings are not accepted, then you basically do not exist. You know, nobody's going to buy you. And then she, through Degas, who befriended her, and through Degas, she gets close to the Impressionists. And the first exhibition, 5 years after they had the first one, so the first exhibition for Marie Cassatt, in which she participates, the Impressionist show, is in 1879. And she had something 10 or 11 canvases there being exhibited. And one of them is the one that we saw at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It's called The Woman with a Pearl Necklace in a Loge. So this is a woman all in pink, probably in the loge of an opera or a theater. This is the painting that was accepted.
The interesting thing about this painting, if you look at it, the thing that stands out to me is that there seems to be a mirror image on her left.
Uh-huh.
Is she sitting in front of a mirror?
No, I don't know if this is in front of the mirror, but I think, you know, she's placed with all this world behind her, you know, because you see the other loges and other boxes behind her. To me, she's like a debutante at her first, you know, public showing. And the world is looking at her and she's looking at the world. The one thing that she's definitely not looking at, the way I'm looking at it, is that she's not looking at the performance, you know.
Ah.
So this is about the, you know, kind of, she entered the social scene, if you like, but she's really not relating to the art being performed on the scene.
Is that a metaphor to her not being accepted into the Salon for a couple of years?
You could read it this way. I mean, that's, see, Ricardo, this is the beauty of, you know, going with anybody to see, like you and I went there and looked at paintings. A painting is whatever the painting tells you, you know, whichever way it speaks to you. I might be fascinated by the pink colors of it because I love color and I love the way the things is painted. And you might be looking at the social aspect of it. Every painting, you can find something for yourself in a painting if you look hard enough. In a good one, obviously. If it's a lousy painting, then there's nothing you can, it's not salvageable, right?
It's true.
See, for you, you find different interpretations that would never occur to me. So it's fun to go sometimes to a museum and just look at the painting and say, what does this tell you? And people come up with completely different, because sometimes they draw from their own biography or whatever they have read or seen. Or experience.
Right.
And they just have their own relationship. That's what art is supposed to do, resonate for yourself. The artist just puts something on canvas, and sometimes what the artist puts is completely different than we see 200 years later, because the world has changed and we have a completely different interpretation of what we see.
True.
Right?
So there's not only the individual element of relating to specific emotions that are being portrayed or social elements, but there's also the, what will you say, the current trends in society that are at play, or how people relate to animals and what role they play in society. So there's a bigger, I wouldn't know a fancy word to describe that, but there's a bigger element at play there. And it just underscores that you said at the start of this conversation that you need to take time and focus on one thing if you go to a museum. Because there is something to discover in these paintings. And it's not always 5 seconds of looking at it and then immediately it snaps. Sometimes you need to talk about it and look at it and go have a cup of coffee and come back with a different view. And then it just opens up your world. I'm thinking about, just to throw that in, I'm thinking about what you told me about how some of these paintings changed the era before it and after. And then, for example, the Cézanne painting, how that it has a pre-Cézanne era and there's a post-Cézanne era, and how that broke up the way people paint it. And once you get that insight and you walk through the museum and you look at similar paintings that were created in the post era, you realize the significance of this pivotal painting that opened up the era, the possibility of people to mimic that style of painting. It's just fascinating. That's why I love traveling with you through these museums. If you just buy a ticket and go in, you're never going to discover that yourself.
Well, I agree with you that the worst thing that you can do in a museum is try to see everything, because unless it's a very small place, you get overwhelmed after the third painting, and then there's, you know, the whole section on pots and another on jewelry and another on textiles. And I mean, after 5 minutes, right. So if the big museums, let's say the British Museum or the Louvre, when I go there, and I go there quite often, I just decide in the morning, I'm just going to go to this wing and I'm just going to look at this and nothing else. And to me, a museum is like a candy store, I told you. So I want all the candy.
Your eyes lit up. It was wonderful.
I learned not to do that, because if I do that, then my eyes glaze over and I didn't get anything out of it. And it's fun to go with friends or children, because everybody, if you go with a group of two or three people, I bet you that the same painting is going to have completely different reaction from three different people, because people will see whatever they project their own insights into it. And every painting, they just say, oh, well, I hate this painting because it's dark. And the other person says, yes, right, but it kind of makes me think of my dad or whatever, and completely different reaction. And that's what's joyful, that you can use this painting to basically relate to other people, you know.
Right.
It's fun.
Right.
Well, we've taken a huge amount of time discussing all those paintings, so why not we just do one more painting?
Last one. Well, it was incredibly hard to find. You were like a bloodhound looking for this final painting.
God, we went one floor after the other, you know, one wing after the other. We couldn't find it. The guards had no idea what we were talking about. It was not easy.
But we found her. We scoured the museum and we found Georgia O'Keeffe.
Correct.
Tell us about Georgia O'Keeffe, because her style is very, very different than the ladies we've seen before.
She's the 20th century artist, so obviously it's going to be different. But also, you know, she has something in common with all the women that I was talking about, meaning the kind of carving their own path in art, regardless of the styles and regardless of influences. Because what happens is that for someone who is starting to create in its earnestness or seriousness in, let's say, around 1920, this is the period in art where you have so many other directions. You have surrealism, as expressed by Dali or Magritte or de Chéricault. We will talk about that. you have Picasso, which is Cubism at the time, and you have Fauvism, the paintings of Matisse. You have many different styles that kind of explode at the beginning of the 20th century. So here is a woman who comes out of nowhere. She's 20-something, comes to New York, and she has to make a name for herself. And she has chosen to paint in her own way, kind of, you would call it hyper-realistic, not even surrealist, but hyper-realist, enormous flowers that she's very famous for, or the abstract paintings, but they are kind of on the border of being completely abstract. But if you look at the painting that we have seen, which is called The Orange Streak,
right,
you could argue that this is maybe a painting of a sunset, right? Or the sun coming through in between two things. She was living in New York at the time in a high-rise building, you know, 50th floor of, you know, in Manhattan. So she would see the sun as in between those tall towers, right? Kind of right. Street between. But obviously she didn't paint the realistic, you know, office buildings. She would paint what she painted, which is this kind of abstract lines. She really kind of exploded with her own very characteristic style when she went to New Mexico and started painting the desert and flowers and skulls of bulls in the desert, kind of, you know, that kind of style. And that was her world. She talks about it in her letters or memoirs, that she really came to maturity in her art is when she finally left New York and started spending big part of the year in New Mexico, and that the desert spoke to her. This was the land that inspired her. So for everybody, you know, for one person, they get inspired when they go to the sea and they look at the sky and water. And for somebody else is going to the desert and looking at dry plants. So
see, that's back to my earlier point about you need to understand the historical context to truly appreciate these paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Because you look at O'Keeffe's paintings when she was still living in the concrete jungle of New York,
mm-hmm.
where services were readily available, there was a grocery store around every corner, and then this lady decides to pioneer into the United States, the western side, where you have no plumbing, no running water, and she becomes an adult in her style of painting, and her painting style changes, and all of a sudden she's painting a very different way of seeing the world around her. And you need to understand that context to really appreciate the reds, the orange streak, the red and orange you see in this painting, and the sun going through those buildings, and then the very vivid bullhead, the skeleton. There's a context to it, a historical context around their lives. This is fascinating stuff if you understand it.
Yes, the biography of a painter, knowing a little bit of the biography of the artist always helps, because you kind of understand where they're coming from, which is not to say that you have to. The beauty of art is also that you don't have to know anything about the painter and can still speak to you as artwork or whatever inspires in you. But it obviously changes the perspective. So sometimes the good thing is just to look at a painting, see how it speaks to you, and then find out more about it, and the perspective shifts. So that works too.
Which, the perfect example of that to me was, I knew that I appreciated paintings that are vivid, very realistic, day-to-day scenario that I engage in. So for example, this painting right next to me is something that speaks to me because it is the place I grew up in. It's Rotterdam. In historical context, we saw Richard Ansdell and George Stubbs with the paintings of hunting scenarios from 100 years ago or 200 years ago, where you see a very vivid scenario of a guy standing over an elk that he just shot, and the bloodhounds are still around it. And it's a scenario that I can relate to, it's something that's very easy to understand, if you will. But then you and I, as we crossed through the Barnes Foundation first and then the Philadelphia Museum of Art, we stumbled upon an artist that I had no clue that I would love so much, which is the Chirico, Giorgio Di Chirico, which is, correct me if I'm mistaken, he spent his life in Italy, but he grew up in Athens, in Greece. And his style of painting is very different than all those very realistic paintings that we were describing before. But somehow it spoke to me. Somehow it just stood out. And if you look at that wall of all these different paintings, this is the one that was speaking to me. And I just wanted to look at it for 10 minutes at a time. And I can still to this day not explain why. But there seems to be some, when I look at his Red Tower, for example, or the one with the square, if you look at this, it's almost like a little world in itself where there's so many question marks, but somehow you can relate to it. And when I looked at the one on the square, it took me back to my travels in Cuba,
mm-hmm.
because of maybe the Greco-Roman elements hidden in there. But because it's empty, it almost leaves it open for interpretation. So it almost lets me, as the viewer, interpret it in my own way. There's a lot of room for me to interpret it in my personal world and my personal experiences. I don't know whether that plays a role or it's just the way he uses the colors that are really juxtaposed. I don't know, it's that. So this is where I'm going to rely on you to help me understand why I like this painting, because I don't know.
Well, You know, to answer the last question that you asked, I have a feeling that you respond to the fact that most of the Surrealist paintings have a mystery in them, because they show you some non-existent fantasy world, which is populated with various interesting elements. The least, like this Magritte, who is the master of them all, is probably even the better. So you kind of engage with the painting trying to figure out a mystery. I mean, that's how people were attracted to reading mystery novels, right? Because they were trying to figure out who did it or how was it done or what is going on. And these kind of paintings do not just give you, okay, this is the landscape of a tree and a lake, right? They give you a world that you don't know because it's a fantasy world, right? You enter that world and then you try to figure out what it's about, and you can populate with whatever you want. You know, you can create your own story. So I personally love Surrealist art beyond measure, and I have several Surrealist paintings on my walls. One is behind me, I think I can even see. So I totally understand your love, but what I find fascinating is that we went in search of, after all, realistic paintings by women of the 17th, 18th, 19th century, which are very interesting as art, and they're very good works of art, but they are still living within the world of realism, if you like. And what you ended up loving was a complete surprise, something extremely modern, something very rich in possibilities of interpretation. And that's what happens in museums. People just go there for one thing and they get something completely different.
Right.
And you had no idea that you're going to love Surrealist art or de Quirico, who is not that well known, less known than Magritte. And you probably haven't seen any paintings of him because there's not that many in the museums. And it was a total surprise. And you just go there and it's like, oh my God, I didn't know that I liked that. It's almost like going to a different city, right? You go to a city because you go on a business trip or whatever, and then you find some places like, I didn't know that I liked that. I just
found it. It's a discovery. Right. It's an adventure. It's an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it was certainly an adventure, and I'm glad you took us through the museum. So I have to know, what is the one you would take home?
Ooh. That's very, very difficult. I cannot answer that easily because there were too many things that I have liked over there. So I cannot really answer that question.
The kid in the candy store suffers from the Godiva chocolate problem.
And the can of wars. It probably would be one of the Cezannes because I love Cezanne so much. But there's too many paintings there. You know, I would definitely recommend for people to go and check it out. Right. I did love this George O'Keeffe very much because this is the type of paintings that I would like.
Just to stay with the Cezanne for a second, you explained his very unique way and him being truly a master of painting fruit, where to the untrained eye, it looks very simple. But once you see his unique style, you can't unsee it. And everything else, correct me if I'm wrong, Renard did it too, trying to paint fruit, but his style was just, it was just second to Cézanne. Once you see Cézanne's beauty and his...
It was a little bit more traditional. I mean, definitely, you know, if you just look at the painting of, you know, apples and pears by Cézanne, and if someone says, well, you know, this is just apples and pears and they are nice colors, but whatever, then I challenge this person to get a box of paint and try to recreate what Cezanne has spent his lifetime, you know, perfecting. And then you discover how difficult it is to replicate even his painting. And there is, even for the impressionists as expressed by Renoir, even though they were not doing one-to-one kind of realistic painting, making sure that it's almost like a photography, because obviously the art has moved on. And that's what the core of Impressionism is, that they are trying to capture the light and the color as it is perceived and the given moment. And their brushwork is always kind of very fast because they're trying to paint while they're standing in front of a landscape and they have to catch the moment. But even for the Impressionists, it's still trying to render what they see in front of their eyes, right? Meaning, you know, the realistic, or maybe not the style, but the image of whatever they see. Once you go to modern art, if it's like really sophisticated style like cubism, then of course, you know, everything is perceived through cubes, for example. Or if you go through abstract art, then obviously this is not going to be representation of actual objects in a realistic way. But until you go to those more complex styles, there is Cézanne, who is in the middle, who is theoretically painting a bunch of apples on a table, right? But he spends so much time trying to figure out the colors, the shapes, and how the eye actually perceives things. And our eyes constantly go from left to right. You know, we look at an object from various angles, even unconsciously, because we move our body, we move our head, we move our eyes. And we don't look statically at anything, because that's not how the human body functions. So that's what he's trying to capture. So he moves beyond just looking at the object as something that is static and that you're trying to render as faithfully as you can. He's trying to do a composite of all the possible ways of looking at things. And that's what the modern art is. And it's also he's painting what he perceives in terms of color, in terms of shape, what he sees, and not what the convention would say. In other words, the artist, you look at the work of art because you're looking at the individual point of view. You're not looking at the work of art because it was created for you to decorate the wall. And this is a big difference in art. You know, it's much more complicated than that, of course. But I think that at the end of the day, same way you and I went to the museum and we have kind of viscerally responded to Cézanne paintings because they are beautiful. We may not even know why. We don't need to know the theory of art. It's just look at this. And it's like, look at this. Look at those colors. Look at those apples. I mean, they are incredible. It's just something that you just look at it. And if you have one wall of paintings and there's one Cézanne there, you're just going to be drawn to it because there's something that draws you there.
It sticks out. It just sticks out. And you really have to enjoy these paintings in real life. There's a difference between looking at a screen and an LED screen and looking with your own set of eyes in person in a museum. So I would encourage everybody to go out and enjoy these museums in real life. It is a blessing, and it's been a blessing having been able to do that together with you, Miss Hein. It's been a lot of fun. Yes, we will. I look forward to that. It's been a real pleasure, and I've learned a tremendous amount from you. So thank you very much for that. I jokingly told you when we were in the United States, there is a pre and a post Cézanne era. There is a pre and a post Nina Hein era for me. So,
wow, too grand.
So thank you very much. Well, you're playing a big role in my appreciation of the art. So I want to thank you for that. And I very much look forward to reading your book too.
When it comes out, yes, we hope.
when it comes out. So hopefully that will be soon. And we're also going to be updating the Food for the Soul website. So stay tuned for that, ladies and gentlemen. Nina, any final notes from your end? Is there anything you would like to discuss or inform people
about? No, I just would like to encourage everybody to go to any museum nearby and just, you know, take kids, take family, whatever, and just choose one or two paintings that, as Catherine says, you would take home, meaning choose the one that speaks to you best, and have, you know, read maybe a biography of whoever painted that, and just have fun. Museums are for fun. They are not work.
Right, and reserve time to do it. Don't rush. Just take your time. And playing this game, I think, can be a lot of fun with kids too, getting them interested. Because if you play this game, what would you take home? They're going to actively look for their favorite painting. So that's a nice trick of engaging your children too. which I'm certainly in my situation going to do when they're a little bit older. So
exactly.
Nina Hein, thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to Nina Hein and myself talking about the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Stay tuned for the book coming out. And until next time, thank you.
Thank you.